So I was unsure initially what to explore today. I was thinking of something that would follow from what we did last week, where I brought in some of the connections between Buddhist practice and the life and work of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., and explored that and had a few audio excerpts from Dr. King's speeches. And I wasn't sure what I would do, and everything consolidated this morning. Many of you know, many of you are involved with the creative process, and sometimes things are unclear and then whoop, they become clear. How many people know that process in some aspect of one's life? So that's what occurred to me. I was actually part of a group, which I'm part of, a monthly group, which is people from all over the, I think just the U.S., but all over the U.S. It's a small group, but it's a group that is made up of people of Jewish background who are looking and who are all Buddhist practitioners and looking at issues of race and racism. And today, we actually shifted a little bit and we're looking at issues related to Israel-Palestine. And anyway, the whole discussion and the way we were going brought up to me what I wanted to explore today, in light of the many challenges that we find occurring in the world right now. It's a lot to hold, and some of us may pull back from the news. Some of us may just take things in and be a little overwhelmed, but there's so much that's going on, that's painful. And so I wanted to name some of that, but then speak about how to be skillful being with the challenges of our world. So I was thinking, of course, there was the recent police murder of Tyre Nichols. Many of us paid attention to that. There's the earthquake in Turkey and Syria. Today's estimate said more than 33,000 people killed. Right there, there's the war in Ukraine. I think in the last few days, 100 missiles fired by the Russians towards the energy system of Ukraine and a lot of civilian targets as well. And I read that Ukrainians have 60,000 dossiers on potential war crimes. 60,000. Right. And we have the conflicts that are less on center stage in Yemen or in Burma or Myanmar. We have the climate crisis. We have the challenges of whether democracy will continue in this country, in many parts of the world. And I was cognizant of the high levels of disrespect shown at the recent State of the Union. And I actually read something interesting, which was that a lot of the Republicans who were saying things like liar and so forth, they were actually breaking the rules of Congress. But the rules of Congress have to be enforced by the Speaker of the House. And actually, for someone to say liar during a talk breaks the rules, but needs to be enforced and is not being enforced. One scholar of political science said this: in old established democracies, when you see an increase in this type of behavior, it's usually symptomatic of a breakdown in democratic norms. So we have that level of crisis as well. So how can we be with these crises, this pain of the world from the perspective of our practice. What we might say is a right view or wise view in relationship to the pain of the world. How do we get caught in unwise views or unskillful views and unskillful ways of reacting in relation to the world? So I want to answer those questions by naming 10 ways of responding to the pain of the world. And we may feel called by one or two of them, or we may be called by all of them, but particularly by one or two. There are a lot. And I have to say also that when I'm speaking, I'm not coming from a place of expertise and I've got all this worked out, just to be clear, that when I give a talk like this, and probably most of my talks, I might say to myself, you should listen to what that guy is saying. Pay attention, Donald. hear what's being said. So 10 ways of practicing. Number one, ground in right view or wise view. So what is that? And I should say that the very term right, the word that's translated as right is sama. And right is kind of a Victorian era translation. It's probably better translated by words like developed or mature. You know, the word sama is related to words like summary. And so it really has to do with, we might say, a realized or a developed or even a perfected way of holding a skillful view. So just that's important, because we can get confused and think that right view is about being dogmatic or something like that, or holding a particular position. That's really about the maturity. And the word view is connected with a sense of vision. So we could say that this is a developed vision of how we approach life. That's most deeply what so-called right view or wise view is about. Are we holding a perspective about how to live more and more of the time? And the most basic way that the question of wise view gets explicated is by saying that to practice wise view is to understand the Four Noble Truths. And to follow the Four Noble Truths. And in that sense, we can connect it with some of the talks that I've given on dukkha and the end of dukkha, where I've identified the core meaning of dukkha as reactivity. And we can, go back to the teachings on dependent origination, where in my view, actually, the Four Noble Truths are in some ways expressed more clearly in dependent origination. This is basically saying that when there's something painful, we will tend to reactively push it away. When there's something pleasant, if we're not aware, not mindful, we will reactively grab hold. And so wise view is seeing all that. Wise view in relationship to the pain of the world is noticing how we become reactive in some way towards that pain, which might lead us to numb out or to maybe take a fixed view or a dogmatic position. Extremely common, right? There's pain at injustice, and I take on a dogmatic view on the side of justice, right? Very common. I demonize my opponents. So right view is to really hone in on noticing reactivity and noticing when our views get caught up in reactivity. You know, and so we can remember other expressions of skillful view or wise view or the teachings of the two arrows. Remember that, where it's saying when we have pain, the first arrow, we will tend to shoot a second arrow as if that would help. In other words, we're reactive. It's another expression of that. That's a skillful way of seeing things. And the other, you know, another expression of wise view is given sometimes by the Buddha, is that there actually are no ultimate answers at the level of views to the most fundamental metaphysical questions. The Buddha says all views are at best helpful from a practical perspective. That's really helpful to remember, right? One of my teachers a long time ago, he said this can be expressed as all theories leak. All views leak. Nothing holds up in some absolute way. So that's number one. Be guided by skillful views, particularly about the sources of reactivity. Number two, be aware of unskillful views in oneself and in others, which would again be notice when I cling to views, when I'm reactively holding on to views or pushing away the views of others in a reactive way. We can also really try to see that more clearly, know what our views are. Know most basically that when there is pain that I'm having, I will tend to produce reactive views. You know, those of you who've practiced on the judgmental mind with me know that one of the core insights in working with the judgmental mind is that most expressions of the judgmental mind, you know, particularly negative judgmental expressions, can be traced to unacknowledged or unprocessed pain that we are reacting towards. And that one of the ways of working with unskillful views is to more fully touch the pain. That's a major way that I work, you know, with people with the judgmental mind. We can also see where other people are caught in reactive views. Sometimes that's easy. We look at political views, pretty easy to see, but it's helpful really to name it, really to name that that's the case. Oh, there is a reactive view. There is someone holding on tightly in that way. You know, to see how so many situations come out of reactivity. Number three, remember, again, this is remember when we're with the pain of the world, to remember the vision of awakening. We could express this in a variety of ways, that awakening is our most deep nature. You could turn off, if you could turn off your, everyone could mute, that would be helpful. That awakening is our most deep nature. Another way to say it is to remember, how do we keep on remembering that non-reactivity or love or metta or awakening or freedom is our deeper nature? Can we remember that when we're reading the news or listening to the news? So again, I'm saying all these things partly to myself. How do we remember the vision of awakening? You know, I read last time from the Dhammapada, those who fully cultivate the factors of awakening, give up grasping, enjoy non-clinging, are luminous and completely liberated in this life. How do we keep in touch with that? Or from Dr. King, the arc of the moral universe is long, but it points towards justice. How do we keep remembering that when we're in the middle of being with the pain of the world? And remembering, this is number four, how that vision is connected with a sense of warmth, loving kindness towards all beings. How can we be in touch with that? For me, really crucial. I do the radiating metta practice, which goes out in all directions. I do that every day. And remember that sense of radiating metta. As much as I can, I try to do radiating metta on Zoom. Try it. maybe we'll do that later. You know, remembering the lines from the Metta Sutta, radiating kindness over the entire world, upwards to the skies and downwards to the depths, outwards and unbounded, right? That's again, the vision of holding all beings with kindness, very parallel to what I mentioned last time from Dr. King, the sense of the beloved community. You know, Dr. King says the end is reconciliation. The end is redemption. The end is the creation of the beloved community. It is this type of spirit and this type of love which can transform opposers into friends, which can bring about miracles in the hearts of human beings. How do we have the kind heart for all? And I think a key aspect of this is practicing empathy. Doing empathy as a practice where we listen deeply to both ourselves and others. I think listening deeply is a crucial aspect of ways to respond, listening to others. You know, that it's a deep metaphor in spiritual practice. Milarepa, who's back here on my wall, I don't know if you can see it. If I raise it up a little bit, you can see he has his hand like this, listening, deep listening to the world. Or we think of, in a similar way, Kuan Yin, she who listens to the cries of the world. Empathy and deep listening, I think, is a fundamental practice. This is from Thich Nhat Hanh. Deep listening is the foundation of wise speech. If we cannot listen mindfully, we cannot practice wise speech. When communication is cut off, we all suffer. When no one listens or understands us, we become like a bomb ready to explode. Restoring communication is an urgent task. Sometimes only 10 minutes of deep listening can transform us and bring a smile back to us. The Bodhisattva Kuan Yin is the one who hears the cries of the world, listening deeply without judging or reacting. So this is something we can bring into daily life. See what makes empathy hard. See what makes deep listening hard. See what makes it possible. Number five, and this is a challenging one. Be with the pain of the world in one's life. Hold it with compassion. This for me is a way of practicing. Can I be with the news as part of my practice? Be with the pain, do compassion practice in relationship to what's happening. You know, what's very typical in our relationship to the world news? Probably some kind of numbing, right? How many people can relate to that? We sort of just numb out, right? It's, oh, hearing that news again, or, you know, and it gets often gets framed in a way that it's not necessarily easy to go to empathy or compassion. I find it really important to do periodic rituals with a group. And then maybe we can do this here further, where we open to the pain of the world. You know, those of you who've done work with Joanna Macy know that this is at the center of the group work that she has developed over the last 40 years, you know, with colleagues. And, you know, for me, having practices and rituals to touch the pain that we feel, transform things. I can remember when I was first training with Joanna, it was a long time ago. It was over 30 years ago. It was right at the time of the first Gulf War. And we had a week-long training that occurred right after the U.S. started bombing in Iraq. And I had been doing a lot of organizing in the months before that, working with Buddhist Peace Fellowship, but I was pretty much numb after the bombing. I could feel that. And we did these practices for a weekend. And I could feel, particularly with one practice called the Truth Mandala. Some of you know this. It's an hour and a half long practice, typically, where people are in a group and people one or two or three at a time go to the center of the room. We did this with 70 people and go to the center of the room and speak about the pain coming through them. And I did this and I experienced actually the pain related to the war merging with the pain of racism, merging with other pains, but it was touching the pain. And I felt after that weekend, my numbness was gone and I could act. I think we carry that numbness. We need these kind of rituals. And I was speaking with just a few days ago with Aya Santachita, who has moved to San Rafael and is developing a room. And we talked about using this room as a place to do practices, including these kind of rituals. You know, our focus there is especially on climate issues. But I think having these ways, especially at a group level, of touching the pain. I was also thinking of how when I did, I've done several 4 or 5 day retreats on Buddhist practice and transforming racism. I was thinking of one time, and these were both done in the South. And I remember at our retreat, we had this, we did the ritual with the Truth Mandala, and people went deeply into it. We had people there who had ancestors connected with one with slave owning and another one with being, you know, family was, had soldiers in the Confederate Army. And they were able to go very, very deeply and powerful into their pain in ways that I think had not happened before. We need to find ways to do this in relation to the pain of the world where it gets stuck. You know, and I think we need to do this very much in groups. Number six, know how to resolve differences and conflicts in yourself and in your immediate relationships. And so this is something I could, you know, I've taught on sometimes, but maybe could teach on again, which is finding ways to really approach differences and conflicts as opportunities for learning and opportunities to find what we might call win-win or both-and solutions and to move towards that. Sometimes that doesn't happen immediately. We have to move through a ceasefire sometimes or compromise, but eventually we will, you know, I believe that every conflict permits a vision of meeting the needs of all concerned. I believe that with Israel-Palestine. I believe that with all conflicts. But we need to have good mediators, you know, and I've learned to have that vision and trust in it from myself having done quite a number of mediations with groups and with individuals. But it's something that we can study and learn. You know, the basis for skillful work with differences and conflicts is number one, empathy and deep listening to the other one involved. Number two, asking the question, what is the deep need of the other? Or if we're a mediator, what are the deep needs of those or the the deeper needs of those involved. And then bring that ability out to look at the issues of the world. Number 7, commit to and practice non-harming and non-violence at all levels of one's life. You know, non-harming is at the core of Buddhist ethics. It was at the center of Dr. King's work. From the Buddha, let one not destroy life nor cause others to destroy life, nor approve of others killing. You know, and I think we looked at Dr. King some a week ago, the way he said the means have to be as pure as the ends. And nonviolence is the deliberate intention in all parts of our lives not to cause harm in ourselves or in others. King talked about it as having love at the center of one's life. We could say having awakening, love, non-reactivity at the center of one's life. Again, this is all ongoing practice. And so study nonviolence, study the lives of the great exemplars of nonviolence. There are beautiful curricula out there. One can study this, you know, and maybe I'll do this again. I've offered a few times short retreats at Spirit Rock, typically with my colleague Kazu Haga, who's written a wonderful book on nonviolence called Healing Resistance. And we've done up to several day retreats, and maybe we'll do those again in the summer. Number 8, keep practicing all of the above in daily life. You know, what's really crucial about all this is that everything I've mentioned is valuable at a larger level, at a collective level, but it's also can guide our day-to-day lives. So, and that what I have found from several decades of engaged practice is that the core principles are the same, whether we're talking about our own individual practice, our relationships, or the larger collective setting, you know, complex situations in the world. The core principles are the same. And so practice, commit to practicing non-reactivity, wise view, empathy, deep listening, skillful work with conflict, and so forth. This will all then help one to be with the issues of the world. Number 9, we're getting towards 10. We're getting there. Okay, number 9. Wasn't that in a Beatles song? Number 9, I think. Anyway, giving a talk, memory operates on many levels. So here we go. Number 9 is be aware of the different levels of responding to the issues of the world. And here I'm particularly inspired by Joanna Macy. She said that for the great turning towards a sustainable world to happen, we need 3 levels of response. The first is holding actions to prevent further damage. This would be much of usual activism. Secondly, understanding the core institutions and changing them. Creating alternative ways to do education, farming, economics, everything. And number 3, more individually, seeing in a different way, having a different way of perceiving. We could really more generalize and say that we have social action, number 1. We have bringing about changes at the institutional level, at the community level, number 2. And number 3, individual practice on many levels. And, you know, Gandhi had a very similar model. Gandhi talked about the practice of self-purification, but then also there was, of course, nonviolent action. And there was also what he called the constructive program, the development of alternative institutions. Some of you may remember, for him especially important was developing local sustainable economy. For him particularly, he emphasized the spinning wheel. Probably many of you remember that, right? And so when we name those three, it becomes a question of which of those most appeal to me? Which of those most call me? Which of those three? The key is seeing where one is called and then also seeing how they're all connected. And then lastly, this is important. See what issue or issue calls you and how you might be involved. And I think I've mentioned sometimes working with a few people. You know, I think of one person in particular. We had kind of a very straightforward approach. She said, I want to be contributing more to the healing of the world. And I said, which issue do you want to deal with? So choosing one issue. And she said, climate. And then I said, how much time do you have? And she said, 5 hours a week. Okay. And then I said, research several possibilities for you to be involved, maybe research organizations where you could work 5 hours a week. Come back next time we talk and talk about the options and see where you're called. That process within a few weeks had her involved at 5 hours a week in a way that she's still involved. This was like 3 years ago, right? And so if you're interested, see what calls you, and it might not be 5 hours. It might be 5 hours a month, right? But just see, and because having some way that each of us is responding to the world is really, really crucial. You know, and I know, Angela Zarian said once, action alleviates anxiety. There's a way that if we are working, you know, for me, you know, the areas that call me, I guess there's more than one, you know, having spent time in Israel and several trips to the West Bank, I'm very called to help in that way. And I'm helping in small ways, you know, supporting the development of a mindfulness center in the West Bank. We've had various events that have helped with that. And then helping in small ways to talk with teachers, Israeli teachers, to help them bring focusing on the Israel-Palestine conflict more into their teaching. You know, a lot of people there have worked individually, but not so much in the teaching. They've been part of practices. And then for me also, as many as we know from last week, teaching on the issue of Buddhist practice and transforming racism. And then I also feel drawn to work in some ways on climate issues, which I've done in small ways over the years. So see where you're called, you know, and I'll close with another way of saying that many of you probably have heard from the great African-American activist and scholar, Howard Thurman. Asked by a young man in the early 70s, what should I do? He said, don't ask what the world needs. Strange response from an activist, right? Don't ask what the world needs, but rather ask what makes you come alive, because what the world needs is people who have come alive. So I'll stop with that, and let's have us just sit for a minute or two now. So see if there is some reflection or sharing or question arising. And let's open things up to anyone who wants to share. Maybe first, Liz.
Hi, Lidong. I've been thinking a lot about equanimity. And I realize I don't understand how to get there. And I'm wondering about equanimity in terms of dealing with the pain of the world.
Yeah.
I've thought a lot about equanimity as spiritual bypass. That's meant spiritual bypass for me a lot in the last couple of years. So can you relate the pain of the world to equanimity for me?
Yes, thanks, Liz. Really, really crucial question. The translation of upekkha as equanimity may resonate a little strangely for us because we don't use the word equanimity much in daily English. And it can sometimes carry connotations of being a little bit aloof. Can sometimes has connotations of what we call spiritual bypassing. And many of you know that the occupational hazard of equanimity is traditionally called indifference, which could be a kind of spiritual bypassing. I take refuge in my ability to be a meditator and so forth, and I kind of don't pay attention. But that's the occupational hazard, and true equanimity is deeply connected with action and deeply connected with response. Essentially, equanimity is non-reactivity and being able to be with what's present and respond skillfully. That's the essence of equanimity. And it's particularly learned by, in my experience, by times that we lose it. Equanimity is especially learned by times where we are caught in reactivity, but study it and work with it, with skillful practice. So I learn about how to be equanimous with fear by studying fear and being with fear. I learn how to be more equanimous with anger by studying anger. I learn how to be more equanimous with people with different views by seeing how I get knocked around by other people's views, right? So that's the learning process. And again, in the teaching of the Brahmavihara, equanimity is directly linked with loving kindness, compassion, and joy. So mature equanimity has those heart qualities integrated in them. And so it's a beautiful quality. And I think it is, like, partly even the word, as I mentioned, can be misinterpreted, but it actually could be translated as balance also. It's a quality of balance with whatever comes up, and it comes, true equanimity is the fruit of experience, as I was saying. True equanimity is having balance in what previously knocked me off balance or led me to numbness or whatever. Yeah, that's a beginning response. Yeah, thanks, Liz. Really crucial question. Yeah. And welcome people if you want to share some of the ways you may have been active in the world, and I know that many of you are involved, and what's helped, in terms of some of what I named. Yeah, you could ask specifically about one of those 10. I don't personally remember all of the 10 right now, but I have my notes in front of me. Okay. Sherry and Bowman.
Yeah, Don, thank you for this. This is really important. This is really, really great information. And the one that you said about number 10 with the action reducing anxiety.
Yeah.
So about 15 years ago, I lost my son to suicide.
Hmm. Yeah.
The third member of my family to die that way.
Hmm.
And the thing that kept me alive, as you say, you know, this is a core issue for me. And I, you know, looked into resources of what could be done. And I started a walk in New Jersey for out of the darkness, for suicide prevention. And that walk still goes every year. So it's been, you know, 15 years of people being able to come together who have lost someone to suicide. And it's just the ripple effect of that is enormous. And, you know, sometimes I feel guilty that I can't be there and continue to do that work. So I try and do it in small ways, like on Facebook, there's some, you know, parents who've lost your child to suicide and that kind of thing. But thank you for that, because that's, I didn't realize that that's what it was.
Yeah. Sherry, could I ask a question of you?
Absolutely.
You'd be willing to share, how was your process of being with kind of what for me would be unimaginable pain? And how did that process of then developing a way of acting in the world, how was that connected with a way of being with the pain and even healing?
I think that compassion for others is what I learned from that. You know, that kind of excruciating pain is intolerable. And, you know, it teaches me that other people have excruciating, intolerable pain in their life. It doesn't have to be something as big as what I've suffered, but, you know, people have that. And really, honestly, the only thing that really I find healing is when I meet another person who has suffered this loss, and there is just an immediate, very powerful connection.
Hmm.
And it comes up.
Yeah.
One of the things that I did was I have on my wrist a tattoo of a semicolon. And what it is the international sign for suicide prevention.
Hmm.
And many people don't know that. So people will ask me, what is that tattoo on your wrist all about? And I tell them it's, you know, International Sign for Suicide Prevention. And it opens the conversation. It makes it safe to talk about.
Yeah, thank you so much for sharing, Sherry. And I was thinking that just the core principle of meeting pain with a skillful response is also the basis for what people call restorative justice, right? Mm. Rather than meeting pain with inflicting further pain. You know, it's that there's going to something like restorative justice. You know, I was aware, some of you may know, a woman who was killed in the last few days, Jen Angel, from a robbery in Oakland, and she died. She was, you know, she was killed by being dragged by a car. And she was an activist, And her friends and community said, we don't want to send the perpetrators to jail. We want restorative justice. We don't want to meet harm by creating further harm, which is in the spirit of nonviolence. So I'll bring in that point as well. You can read about that. It's in, actually, I think in today's San Francisco Chronicle. Other sharing or questions? Yeah, Avita, please.
As always, Donald, thank you. I get overwhelmed because it's all important. What helps me a lot is being with a group of like-minded people doing the same thing. So yeah. Whether it's 1,000 grandmothers for future generations, whether it's my racism circle, or dismantling racism circle, I find that helps. At least it feels like I'm doing something, but yeah. I don't really feel like I'm impacting. And of course, I want to change the world like the rest.
Yeah, thanks, Vita. There are two points there that I think are real crucial. One is the place of kind of home groups where you can have as a home group for action or for talking together. Really, really crucial. I didn't mention that. I could have mentioned that as a 11th principle, but 10 was is a good number historically for the Buddha or for Western culture. So I went with 10, but being connected with home groups is really, really crucial. So I think having that is very valuable. And then the other point is we don't always know the consequences or the impact of what we're doing. But I think that's where it's helpful to remember that model from Joanna Macy, that changing how we see things is part of great transformation. And we may be focusing on that and not necessarily clearly affecting at the moment action in the world, but all changes require a large change in how people see things. And so being part of that can be held maybe as part of a larger change. So you don't have to look for immediate action. I think to know that one is part of one of those three ways that things change, that's enough. And you can have confidence that, you know, and a lot of the research on nonviolent action makes very similar points. It shows that when there's a critical mass of people with certain views, things change. And so, yeah, thanks. Yeah, Rick, do you have something, please? Rick, if you have something, you're muted.
Okay. I've been very active in politics, revolutionary kind of politics, my whole life. And I've been all these different campaigns, and I've seen a lot of people have the calmness and the centeredness and maintain their equanimity, like a coolness under fire sort of thing.
Yeah.
But they don't do it all the time. It comes and goes. And the same with me. Sometimes I would be that way and sometimes I lose it. More often I lose it. You know, the conclusions I've come to is that it's much like the meditation. You meditate and then you get distracted and fall off
right
into various stories and dreams and fantasies, sometimes nightmares, and you just keep back to the breath. And it's the same with being active. The problems will always be there. In fact, they recur. They go in cycles. They come back again. The same ones that were once solved come back again, because they're never really solved. Anyway, the problems will always be there, and the action will always be needed. And you just do what you can as long as you can, and then you go back to the breath. You start over again. You're just always starting over again. And the little things count. You never know. A long time ago, I knew this very famous activist, Bill something. He was a union guy. I think he fought in Spain. Anyway, he once said, you just keep doing it. You hand out a flyer. You never know. That guy might do something very useful and helpful to the world. And you just keep at it. And I've had that experience myself. A few things I've done have inspired other people to do things. And it's kind of like the butterfly effect, you know? I never know what little contribution you make might help out and make the world a better place. And I also recommend looking at the long picture, you know? Like Martin Luther King and others have said, the world changes for the better and changes toward justice. But it takes a long time, and you can't see it. And it takes more than one lifetime, and you can't see it. So you have to look at the long, big picture and see. Like when my mother was born, she couldn't vote. My grandparents immigrated from the pogroms, you know, just one step ahead of the Cossacks trying to chop off their head. Now we have voting again. And my dad was a fighter pilot, World War II, flew against the Nazis. And now we got Nazis coming back. And you just keep doing it. But it does get better. Things get better. The racism now is in America is they have to be a lot more subtle. It's hidden, you know. Before they just out and out said, you know, people of different races aren't even human. And now nobody can say that anymore. So there is progress. I can cite almost everything that there is progress. It's just hard to see at the time. And for the victims of the current crisis, it's not progress at all. And I don't know, I guess I'm rambling. Equanimity is possible. You just want to have it all the time. You know, I first saw that when I was doing the civil rights movement, and we were invited to stay on this co-op farm in America's Georgia, outside of America's Georgia, while we're doing lots of demonstrating and voter registration and things, and a lot of violence going on. And the Quakers, the American Friends Service Committee, they meditated, and they were the coolest people there of all the different groups and people. And they just kept at it for years and years, and they maintained their cool. I think it was through the meditation course. You know, I tried a little bit of it, and, you know, I was too young and dumb to realize to get much effect out of it, but it did have a small effect on me. Anyway, that's an example of you never know what little thing you do will helps to you know, like being a part of a small instrument in a big orchestra. It helps to further the song.
Yeah, thank you, Rick. Two things especially I want to highlight from what you said. One is that it really was the main emphasis of what I was saying, is that everything is a practice. And we, you know, all of the 10 aspects that I mentioned are practices, which means that sometimes we get it and sometimes we forget it. It's interesting. I never use those two words, like get it sometimes and I forget it other times. Interesting. But that they're all practices, whether it's empathy, deep listening, being skillful with conflict, being skillful with views. All of these aspects, they're practices, which mean we have to keep remembering to have the intention. So that's one point which I want to focus on from what you said. And the other was that we keep acting, and this is related to the conversation with Vita, and we don't always know. We often don't know what the results will be of our actions, but that we really keep with acting. You know, one way that I found this expressed is not knowing, but keeping going. And we keep on acting, and we don't always know the results, but then sometimes we find, oh, that did have results. Or sometimes, again, with the conversation with Vito, it's part of something larger, and it's hard to track. And then all of a sudden, you know, the Berlin Wall falls down, or, apartheid ends in South Africa. And those things were not predicted by the experts, right? They happened in mysterious ways. So let me stop there and then invite, let's go to our closing, because we're at time. I want to, first of all, thank you for listening and participating with this theme, and I hope it was helpful. And I hope that several of the 10 resonated with you, maybe all 10. And so thank you very much. And how many of you would like to follow up with at least some of the 10? How many of them were helpful? Okay, very good.